Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today is Radicals for Peace, Prosperity, and Freedom, answering 10 objections to libertarian anarchism with Dr. Roderick Long. Welcome, Roderick.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we're very, very happy to have you on with us today. So, folks, Dr. Long is a professor of philosophy at Auburn University. He's the editor of the Libertarian Nation Foundation periodical Formulations, and he is an adjunct scholar at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. We also have Radio Free Market show producer and co-host, Mr. Luke McGraw. Welcome, Luke.
Hi, Michael. How's it going?
Excellent. Well, I'm happy to have you as well. So we're going to start in a very interesting way with this show, because this is certainly going to be a very interesting conversation. And Roderick, again, thank you for being here. Before we get on to the 10 objections to libertarian anarchism, I put in the promo for this show that we have on our website that we would start by asking you, what's wrong with a shoe monopoly? So let's start with that question. What is wrong with a shoe monopoly?
Okay, so let's imagine that I have been granted by government a special legal privilege that I and my gang or my family or people I approve of are the only ones who are allowed to manufacture and sell shoes. If you try to set up a shoe factory or a shoe shop without signing up with me, then we go to the government and have them put you out of business, or we come and put you out of business ourselves, whatever. Mm-hmm. So the question is, why would this be a bad idea? And there are several reasons, but I think there are three that come to mind foremost. So first, there's just a moral problem with it. Where do I get the right to claim this monopoly? Why should I be the only one allowed to manufacture and sell shoes? Why shouldn't people be allowed to compete with me? Even if the system had fine results, didn't run into any bad consequences, it still just seems a kind of effrontery for me to be able to claim this privilege just for myself and my friends. So there's that moral objection. Then there's what you might call an incentival objection, which is, this system's going to give me and my shoe monopoly some bad incentives, because I'm going to first of all, I'm not going to have much of an incentive to keep prices low. After all, ordinarily, if I sell very expensive shoes and you can find comparable shoes somewhere else for a cheaper price, you'll go to them, not to me. But if I'm the only one in town allowed to sell shoes, then you've got to meet my price or go barefoot. And so as long as you prefer shoes at my price to going barefoot, you'll come to me. So I'm going to have incentive to have high-priced shoes. I'm also going to have an incentive not to have very high-quality shoes, or not to be very concerned with exactly what kinds of shoes my customers prefer. As long as what I'm offering them is something they prefer to going barefoot, they will still come to me. To the extent that I'm driven by economic self-interest here, I don't have much of an incentive to keep prices low or to keep quality high or to have any interest in what my consumers want. It also puts me in a kind of bad power position.
Well, that's what I was actually going to go to there, is that you've got a quality issue, you've got abusive power issues, and there are special problems with these forced monopolies, and particularly when it's applied to government. Now, we only have about 30 seconds for the answer this question, but could you clarify this term anarchist? You don't mean violence and chaos, right?
Right. Anarchy simply means not having a monopoly over the protection and enforcement of rights.
No, I think that's a very nice definition. I like that one pretty much. So, well, folks, we're going to come into the end of this particular segment, and when we come back, we're going to go into these 10 objections to libertarian anarchism with Dr. Roderick Long. And so please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market, and I have Dr. Roderick Long from the Auburn University, as well as Luke McGraw with us today. And so when we come back, we will get into this and many other issues. So stay with us. We'll be right back. And welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market. So, Luke, please go ahead with the first objection to libertarian anarchism.
Right, cool. The first one, it's a social contract type argument. So people will often say that a government's not a coercive monopoly, that we choose to live wherever we are that's, you know, being ruled by a government, or at least we choose to remain there. What would you say to that kind of something like that, Professor Long?
Yeah, well, I think there are two problems with that argument. One is I don't think it's true that we have consented to government. And second, I think that even if we had, that still wouldn't be a good argument for it. So let me start with the first problem. Clearly, you know, most of us have never officially consented by, you know, signing a document or swearing or anything like that. But the argument's often given, well, by staying within the country and accepting the protection of its services or whatever, you've thereby consented. But the problem, I think, is that that argument tends to presuppose the very thing it's trying to prove, namely the legitimacy of government's rule over this territory. Because if you say, well, when you visit someone's house, you have to abide by their rules while you're there, you're implicitly agreeing to do that. So likewise, when you live in a country, you're agreeing, blah, blah, blah. Well, that assumes that the country is something like, the government is something like the owner of that country. I suppose I just say, well, by living within 1,000 miles of me, you've thereby agreed to, to my authority. Or by benefiting from me by, I don't know, reading my blog or something, you've thereby, you know, consented. Well, what gives me authority over that, you know, that 1,000-mile radius that entitles me to say that? Also, people say people have consented by voting. But, you know, you vote when you do to get rid of the more, you know, objectionable persons, like saying, well, would you rather be beaten, once a day or twice a day? So you vote for the once a day guy and say, aha, well, you've thereby consented to being beaten. Well, not really. But moreover, even if we had consented, it still wouldn't be, a good system. Because if we have a monopoly, they're going to abuse power. They're going to have low-quality services and high prices for the reasons I just mentioned with the shoe company. And also, an additional problem that also applies to the shoe company is, even if you manage to get saints running the thing, who can be trusted not to abuse their power and abuse their monopoly position, still, without competition, they're not going to have a very good idea what kind of services people want, be it shoes or rights protection.
Right.
You know, if I've got the shoe monopoly and I ask my customers, how do you like my shoes, well, what do they compare them with? Compare them with going barefoot? Yeah, I guess we like them okay, they say. Without a price system, without competition, I have no form of feedback to tell me, are there other ways of doing this that are more effective? And likewise, if I'm the government, if I'm imposing this system on everyone, even if my intentions are good, it's hard for me to have any reliable feedback as to what I'm doing.
Yeah, I'm going to insert myself here that Dr. Yermoltsev makes the point that in the Soviet Union, they manufactured more shoes than any other country in the world, except that there was always a shortage of shoes, and there was only a couple of styles, and of course there were a lot of the wrong sizes. And so people got what they got if they could get in line and get what they could get, because it was people would get, 10 pairs of shoes or 5 pairs of shoes, and they would be the wrong size for them and colors they didn't like and things of that nature. So this information problem is a very important aspect to the problems with monopolies. Yeah. So,
all right.
Please,
sure.
Luke, go ahead.
Can I continue? All right, cool. The second objection is that government intervention is needed for social cooperation. So I know that Thomas Hobbes, the 17th century English philosopher, said that in the absence of a sovereign, in the absence of a strong and powerful government, society would degenerate into a war of all against all. So we need to have a government because that allows us to have social cooperation. They provide us with law and order, and they punish people who try and cheat or steal or hurt others. What do you think of Hobbes's argument?
Yeah, well, Hobbes had this argument that without government, your cooperation isn't going to be stable because no one has any reason to expect the other person to keep their side of the agreement. So if I pay you $10 today to deliver some good to me tomorrow, without government to enforce that agreement, I've got no reason to expect you won't just run off with my $10, and so I don't give you my $10. And so then we're both worse off. I don't get whatever it is I wanted from you, you don't get the $10, and so forth. But there's a problem with this argument, which is if you really needed centralized enforcement in order to bring about social cooperation, then how could government ever come into existence in the first place? After all, government is itself a large, complex form of social cooperation. And the people who run the government don't have, you know, superpowers. They're not, it's not through their super strength that the leaders of the government get everyone cooperating. They're, you know, the leaders of the government are outnumbered by the rest of the government, which in turn is outnumbered by the rest of us. It can't be just their own personal might and force that makes us, you know, that makes everyone cooperate. As a matter of fact, there are plenty of incentives to cooperate because, after all, you're not just interacting with this person just once. If you're going to interact with me once and then I'll never see you again, then maybe we have reason to cheat each other. But if it's going to be ongoing and if other people are watching, there are reputation effects.
Mm-hmm. In fact, there you had this whole conversation about from Hobbes that there can't be any law unless it's enforced by physical force. But there were law merchants in the late Middle Ages. You know,
yeah, the law merchant would operate precisely on this reputation basis. And I think that there are legitimate forcible ways of enforcing the law without government as well. But it's also true that in many cases you don't even need force. The law merchant evolved because the government courts were not enforcing international agreements. Each court wanted to apply its own rules, and so they couldn't agree with about any contracts made with another country. And so the merchants all got together and created this system where anyone who didn't abide by these voluntary courts would be boycotted, and it was very effective.
Mark. I was just going to say, even if we did have to have the law enforced by physical force, it doesn't have to necessarily be carried out by a monopolist, because there was medieval Iceland as an example, isn't it?
Yes, in medieval Iceland, from around 930 to 1260, they had a system where the chief form of law enforcement, if you want to call it that, were these chieftains. But the chieftain's territory was not geographic. So you could quit your chieftain and sign up with a different chieftain without moving to a different location. So there was no geographical monopoly. They had genuine competition. And the system worked amazingly well in the sense that when Iceland started off, it was a blood feud culture where if you offended me, then I would kill your brother, and then your other brother would kill my brother, and so on back and forth. And gradually this got tamed, and people became willing to accept, even these Viking types became willing to accept economic restitution rather than violence and so forth. And so if this kind of non-monopolistic legal system can make Vikings cooperate, it really should be able to make anyone cooperate.
I think that's an excellent example, and I would like to refer people to an article that's available on lewrockwell.com. If you go to Roderick Long's archives, the name of the article is Privatization, Viking Style, Model, or Misfortune. It's an excellent article that brings out this particular point, so I would recommend that very highly to our listeners. So, Roderick, objection number three comes from John Locke, another 17th century philosopher whose ideas greatly influenced the founding fathers of America. Would you be able to tell us what his three inconveniences of anarchy, which we like to call peaceful cooperative society, were, and why you don't find his argument very compelling?
Sure. Okay, so Locke was more optimistic about cooperation without government than Hobbes was. That's one reason he was less scared of revolution than Hobbes was. But Locke did think there were three serious problems. One is he thought that there wouldn't be a known and settled law. He thought that people could figure out, without government, some very basic principles, that people have the right to run their own lives and they have the right to keep the fruits of their labor and so forth. But when it comes to applying those in particular cases, you know, you've got water, you've got a stream running from your land onto mine, and then you dam it, and then I complain you're violating my property rights because my stream has dried up, and you claim, no, you're not, because you just did it on your property. You can see how reasonable people who all accepted libertarian property rights could disagree about exactly how to handle these situations. So Locke says, look, you need some organized, settled, known ahead of time body of law, and that's what you need government for. Second, he said, the problem in the state of nature is that people are going to be judges in their own case. If I've got a dispute with you, there's no government to go to, I'll just resolve it on my own. I'll decide And in fact, I'll be judged during execution, and I'll decide you violated my rights. I will decide on the appropriate remedy and so forth. The problem is people tend to be biased in their own favor. And so that's not going to work out too well. And finally, it's like you're not going to have adequate organized enforcement, because although you and your neighbors getting together to, you know, to deal with some, you know, the occasional individual criminal might work, if you have sort of more organized, larger bodies of criminals, you need some kind of organized enforcement. Therefore, you need government.
You know, you make this excellent point that I want to bring out, that it seems like stateless cooperation solves all three of these problems, which actually the state cannot solve.
That's right. I think that, you know, Locke thought he was giving an argument for government. In fact, he was giving an argument for, you know, I'd say a legal system, but not only is government not needed for any of those things, but in particular, you know, government can't properly supply them at all. Take, for example, I think this is clearest in the case of the second one, the problem of people being judges in their own case. Now, I think it's a good principle that if you have a dispute with someone, where possible, leaving aside emergencies and situations and so forth, you shouldn't just resolve it yourself. You should appeal to a third-party neutral arbiter. But it doesn't mean there has to be some one single for all of society third-party arbiter to whom everyone shares their disputes. In fact, if there is, then you've got a violation of the principle, because if you have a dispute with that entity, there's no third-party arbiter for it to submit its disputes to. If you have a dispute with the government, I mean, sure, there's, you know, if the government has division of powers, that makes it a little bit better. But still, if you have a dispute with the government, it's going to be resolved by some branch of the government. And that's
okay. We're going to have to break in here. We're going to have to break in here and take a break. We're going to talk more about this when we come back. So everyone, please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and we'll be back in just a minute. Please stay with us. And welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market. And Luke, let's get going with objection number four.
All right, cool. This is one comes from Ayn Rand, who's made, amongst other people, and she said that if we had private protection agencies providing security instead of government police, that these private protection agencies will fight each other. There'll be a lot of battles going on. So suppose, Roderick, that you and I were to get into a dispute and we both subscribe to different protection agencies, wouldn't these protection agencies then just fight each other?
Well, the thing is that private protection agencies have more of an incentive than governments do to resolve their disputes peacefully. And here's why. War is expensive. Now, if you're a government, you can afford to go to war because you've got a captive customer base, the taxpayers, and you can just extract the money from them, or print money or whatever. You've got other monopolies, too. Anyway, your monopolistic power enables you to foot the bill off onto someone else. Whereas if you are a private protection agency, you have a choice of trying to resolve the dispute by arbitration or to go to war. If you go to war, the monthly premiums you send out to your customers are going to go up. And the customers are going to look at this and say, wow, so I spent this amount on protection against burglary and this huge amount on warfare against protection agencies B, C, and D. can I switch my service? And if you have the right to switch your service, then it's, you know, imagine how hard it would be for the U.S. government to prosecute its wars in Iraq and Afghanistan if people could just look at their, you know, at the breakdown of their monthly bill and say, yeah, can I switch to somewhere, someplace, that some agency that isn't doing that?
I think people will often, they might cheer on and say that they do support a war, but perhaps I think that if they, could choose to not pay for it, I think many of those people might change their minds.
Right.
Yeah, there are many things we might support, but we're not going to be willing to foot the bill for them ourselves.
Yeah, that's right. All right, objection number five to libertarian activism is that in a society without a government, there would be no final arbiter of disputes. So it's possible today to take a dispute all the way to the Supreme Court, but no such thing would exist, though, in a society, in a stateless society. So wouldn't disputes then just go on and on? There'd be no way to resolve them?
Well, it depends what a final arbiter means. If a final arbiter means something that absolutely guarantees that the dispute cannot be further pursued, then I don't think any system has that. I mean, our system doesn't have that. If I appeal my case to the Supreme Court and I lose, well, I can lobby the Congress. I can try to get them to change the law, or I can try and get the Constitution amended, or I can try and vote for or get other people to vote for politicians who will change the law, or I can try to organize a revolution, or whatever. I mean, there's always something I can do. But in practice, most of the time, most disputes get resolved because it's a pain to keep, you know, keep pushing them. And in that sense, if by final arbiter you mean something that realistically leads to disputes finally petering out, well, you know, governments can do that, but anarchies can do that too. And historically, if you look at cases like, you know, medieval Iceland and Anglo-Saxon England and so forth, they seem to have done so.
Yeah, you know, I like the this particular objection, and I liked your answer to it a lot, because you bring out this, you know, very key point that this sort of problem, or this sort of situation, I should say, of no final arbiter exists in every society, or in every system, if you will. And we did a show some time back on Somalia. And the name of the show is More Peaceful, Stateless and, quote-unquote, More Peaceful in Somalia. And it pointed out that in Somalia, by custom, if there's a dispute, then the two tribes basically hire a third tribe that makes a decision. And that becomes the final verdict. And the result of noncompliance is to become an outcast. And that's imbued into the custom of that particular area. And this is a very interesting thing that I know we don't have time to pursue very much with you today, but this concept of shunning or outcastism, if you will, I know it existed in ancient Iceland. It's existed in a lot of different cultures around the world. In the old American West, it was used to enforce rules for wagon trains and mining camps and things of that nature.
We have the equivalent now online and things like eBay. If someone orders something from you and you don't send it, or what you send wasn't what's promised, you get a negative rating. That's like a little bit of shunning, and other people read that, and they shun you a little bit too, and then you don't get as much, you know, as many customers.
It's funny though. I'm sure that before eBay came online, before eBay was created, the economists would probably say that there was that this thing could never work because there'd be an asymmetric information problem.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, explain that term for our listeners, Luke.
Well, that's where one party knows a lot about. So if I'm selling you, let's just say, an iron or something, I might know that it's kind of a little bit defective in a certain way, but you don't know any of this information. So one side knows a lot more than the other side. So they would say that, well, you know, how do we resolve this? Or will a trade actually take place?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and
yet
that assumes,
eBay works really
the
well.
The problem assumes that there's just a one-time interaction. You know, they give you something, it's not what you expected, they run off, and there's never any more interaction. But if you can give them negative, positive, or negative ratings online, and other people can see that, then they have an incentive to correct that problem.
You know, I think it's extremely important for us to take a look at all of these examples, both historic and current, as to how privatization of conflict resolution works and minimizes abuse of power issues and increases quality of life issues. But we're coming to the end of this particular segment, so everyone please stay with us, and we'll be right back right after the break. And welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market. And Luke, please take us on to objection number 6 on the 10 objections to libertarian anarchism.
Great. This one is that laws concerning property can't emerge from the market, and we need the government to provide us with laws about property law, because otherwise we couldn't have market exchanges. So what do you think about that one, Roddy? Do you think that's a valid argument?
Okay, so the idea here is that you can't have market exchanges unless people have, you know, property titles and so forth, so the property already has to be in – property law already has to be in place for there to be a market. So the market can't produce property law. Well, I mean, I think we can see the problem with that if we just sort of picture society beginning and a bunch of people sitting around saying, well, we can't exchange anything yet because first we need to be able to build a courthouse and we really need some cops and so forth. Well, who's paying for the courthouse? Who's paying the cops? I mean, there has to be commerce going on in order for there to be, law and so forth. I mean, law doesn't create food. Someone's got to feed the people who are, you know, who are running the legal system. So it can't be the case that property law comes first and market afterwards. Now, of course, it's true that as society becomes wealthier, can afford fancier legal institutions, and so it goes a little bit here and it goes a little bit there, and they go back and forth. But exchange and commerce and production have to exist before legal systems, because the first thing is people have to be able to eat, and they have to be able to cooperate. They have to be able to cooperate in order to create a legal system. The legal system can't be the precondition of cooperation.
You know, this is such an extremely important point because, you know, people have to understand the sequence of events in the creation of the state. And we used also on our promo the outline of the first chapter of Franz Oppenheimer's book, The State, Its History and Development Viewed Sociologically, that there are six stages in the creation of the state. The first is looting, truce, then tribute, then occupation, then monopoly, and the state. And while we don't have time to go into that in detail today, the sequence has to lays out the understanding that the state doesn't actually produce anything, that there's only a few ways in which the state can actually fund itself. And we've gone over this many times. Our listeners are going to recognize these four that we always bring out. And those are, you know, they can tax, they can borrow, they can inflate money, and they can confiscate. They can take the money away or take the property away from either you or somebody else. And conquests have done that since time immemorial. And but in order for the courthouse and the police to actually get built, commerce has to be a precondition. That's a beautiful point. I just love that point. So now I inserted myself again, Luke. So please go ahead with
the
next one.
Cool. I'll continue with this. Is objection number 7, and this one is about organized crime. So I know people say that if we didn't have a government, if we did live in a society without a state, that we'd all be ruled by the mafia, or by competing gangs like Tony Soprano types or something like that, and they'd be threatening us with violence. What do you say to that, Roderick?
Well, think about where organized crime gets its power. Where does it come from? The things that organized crime specializes in, drugs, prostitution, gambling, back in the 20s, alcohol, are all things that are either made illegal by the government or unusually tightly regulated by the government. And therefore, these are things that are unusually profitable on the one hand, because when the government shrinks the supply that way, it means that it becomes very lucrative to go into that field because there's little competition. And second, because it's unusually risky to provide those things, people who have a high tolerance for risk and violence tend to specialize in them. And so organized crime gets its power from government prohibiting things that wouldn't be prohibited in a free society. I mean, why is it that producers and distributors of alcohol are not shooting each other in the streets nowadays? In the 1920s, they were. And before the 1920s, they weren't. What was it about the 1920s that suddenly made alcohol such a violent trade? Well, it's because it was prohibited and created a natural incentive for organized crime to go into it. The last thing that organized crime wants is for drugs and to be legalized and for regulations to be taken off of prostitution and gambling and so forth. It would take away their niche market.
And I would like to refer our listeners to another show that we recently did with Dr. Mark Thornton called Strange Bedfellows, How Enemies Unite Against Liberty. And he focuses on this exact point. But you make the point very articulately, Roderick. So
yeah,
I have
called the Baptist and bootleggers dynamic.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly what we brought
up there. The people who benefit economically from the regulations have a common interest, as it turns out, with the people who have supposedly high-minded moral reasons for the regulations.
Great. So I have objection number 8, and that is that the rich will rule us. So as an example, they say that you get into a dispute with a very rich businessman, and if he were to take you to court, wouldn't it be more likely that the judge would find in favor of him? He's very wealthy, and so couldn't he just bribe the judge? In other words, wouldn't justice just go to the highest bidder?
Well, I think that's much more of a problem under our current system than under a free market. People have this idea that the free market will be primarily a benefit to big business. But in fact, and the reason they think that is because proponents of the interests of big business are always talking about free markets. If you look at what big businesses actually favor in practice, it's kind of like organized crime in that a lot of their profits come from various kinds of regulation, and the last thing they want is a genuine free market. Now, take, for example, bribery. You get a lot more power bribing the government than bribing a private arbitrator, because a government official controls tax dollars, and so therefore, I only have to, let's say, give $1,000 to a government official to get him to do something that's that costs $1 million, because it doesn't cost him $1 million. If I bribe you $1,000 to do something that's going to cost you $1 million, you're not going to be interested. So I think government magnifies the power of the rich. It tends to create concentrations of wealth, because you get wealth by lobbying the government rather than through competition. So I think actually the rich would have a lot less power. If you really explore it, you find that there are all these regulations that, even ones that are supposedly to benefit the poor, that actually have the effect of decreasing competition, making it harder for small businesses to compete with big business.
I particularly like the development that you did with this particular point. There's an old movie, a Walt Disney movie, Song of the South, and Br'er Rabbit says, "Please don't throw me in the briar patch." And it reminds me of all of the people that are companies that are out there that are seeking regulation for themselves. And it seems so counterintuitive to the general public that why would these businesses seek regulation? Well, they want regulation because it gives them greater exclusivity, reduces competition, greater protections, and so on and so forth. But there's another aspect to this that you brought out here that I'd like to ask you to comment on. Again, I want to refer to Dr. Yuri Maltsev, because he's pointed out that there's a special type of property right holder, and that is the bureaucrat. And the bureaucrat is very special in that he has or she has special privileges that they can decide what we can and cannot do with our property. So, and how they are targeted by bribers in our system isn't necessarily with cash and normal incentives of vacations and whatever, et cetera, but future jobs, future employment. And it's very, very evident if you look at Washington, the industry
door.
That is created. The revolving door.
Yeah,
you find
people going into government bureaucracy, and then they end up going to go out, and they go into the boards of corporations, and they're back in government again. And so, of course, if they're going to be cycling back and forth, it's in their interest. It's in their interest for these two sides to cooperate. If you know that you came from that corporation, you're going back to that corporation. It's in your interest to give special privileges and favors to that corporation. Whereas, the great, huge anonymous masses don't have that kind of access. They can't provide that kind of incentive. I don't think that was voting, and voting is, compared to lobbying, voting is an extremely diffuse and inexact method of feedback. I mean, you can't identify anything in particular. You can't say, I like things X, Y, and Z you did, but not A, B, and C. You just vote for an entire person, and then your vote is aggregated with millions of other people who all have different... voting is not a very good form of accountability.
I think
you also...
Just,
please go ahead, Luke.
I was just going to say that if you were to ask someone to vote on one of two people to go into the supermarket to buy, you know, this week's groceries, I think people would say, that's crazy, they're not going to give me what, you know, what I want. But somehow then when it applies to all the things that government covers, they say, oh, well, let's put it to vote. It just seems kind of silly.
You know, there was other points that you brought up on this particular issue of the rich would rule us, Roderick. I'd like you to comment on the reputation effects, that issue.
Yeah. So suppose that I'm a, I'm a professional arbitrator, and some dispute comes along between a rich person and a poor person, and so the rich person bribes me, and I, and so I side with them, even though pretty clearly I should have sided the other way. Well, that's become going to become pretty clearly known, and not only is that going to make all the poor people unwilling to pick me, but a lot of the rich people aren't going to be too eager to pick me either, because suppose a rich person has a dispute with an even richer person. That rich person isn't going to be too eager to rely on me. And so once this the reputation, if you have the reputation of being susceptible to bribes, it's going to be awfully difficult to maintain your customer base, unless you've got a monopoly.
You know, there's one more thing on this before I turn it back over to Luke. I wanted to ask you to expand on a little bit, and that there is actually this other issue that you brought out again, going back to ancient Iceland, a feature of their legal system, where the poor people were able to actually sell their claims to compensation so that people cannot just victimize poor people and expect to get away with it. Could you comment on that a little bit, expand that a little bit for everyone?
Yeah, so you know, people sometimes say, well, the problem is that if you are, if you're poor and you're weak, how are you going to be able to enforce your claims against some rich and powerful opponent? But if you can sell your claim to compensation, then someone else can acquire that. Someone else with more wealth and more power and more lawyers and whatever can then acquire that from you. In fact, in a sense, we have that now within the current system, to the extent that you have lawyers who take cases on a contingency basis. Meaning, a lawyer who will get paid by you only if they win the case, and if they think your case is good enough, they'll be willing to take it. Well, likewise, then, if I've got some claim that someone thinks has got a good chance of sending up to court, but I can't afford to prosecute the claim, I can sell that claim, and that way I get compensated immediately, and then they can go, and then they presumably will be able to get a still larger amount for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Luke, would you take us on to objection
number nine? Yeah, objection number nine is that the masses will demand bad laws. So if most people in society wanted to outlaw certain kind of books, for example, wouldn't the market then, so that is the system of private protection of agencies and judges and so on, wouldn't they just respond to those demands of different people and give them what they want, which is, even though that those things that, which they want is bad?
Okay, well, think about people who are intolerant of certain books or smoking or sexual practices or whatever it is, you have to distinguish between a large percentage of the population that might care about those issues enough to vote for them versus what's generally going to be the smaller percentage of the population that cares about those things enough to pay for them. So it's one thing to go into a voting booth and say, oh, yeah, I want to ban smoking or homosexuality or certain kind of books or whatever, and they just pull the lever and ban it or vote for the person who's going to ban it. But it's another thing for them, once again, to look at their monthly premium and see, percentage that they're paying each month to peek into people's bedrooms or to peek into their bookshelves and so on and enforce all that. And even if they care a lot about it, there will be some people who care enough about it they'll be willing to pay for it. But by and large, when you basically anarchy increases the cost of intolerance, because in order to enforce your intolerant preferences, you have to do more than just go and pull a voting booth for some intolerant law. You have to actually, pay for it. And so I think that the percentage of people who are willing to pay for it is a lot smaller. And if you have a large enough percentage of people who are willing to pay for it, well, then you're probably going to, then they certainly will be willing to vote for it. So you're not going to be any better off with government or with the democratic government than with anarchy anyway.
Luke, did you have any additional spin on that you wanted to develop?
I guess that's the point, because you can sort of, like we have now in our society, indulge your biases. So if someone, as you're saying, if someone's got a preference for certain things, that, you know, it's, I guess talk is cheap, but once you then have to start to pay for it, I guess you might start to change your mind.
Well, you know, I'm going to jump in, and I'm just going to introduce the final objection, and then we'll start developing this when we get into our next segment, because we probably won't be able to have you finish responding to it while we're talking in this particular segment here, Roderick. But the final objection says that, okay, suppose we were to have a system of privately competing protection agencies. Isn't it possible that they would just eventually become a government? So the powerful firms could just create a cartel and then exclude any competitors from arising, and then wouldn't we wind up with what we have now anyway? So this is very unfair to start introducing this question to you, so you've got 30 seconds, and then we can develop it right after we get back
to
the break.
Okay, well then, essentially the idea is that cartels are very hard to maintain without already having government enforcement in place. I'm not saying it can't happen, but I think that there are good reasons to think that they're going to be, such cartels are going to be much less stable unless you have a government already in place to enforce them. And I'll expand on that when we come back.
Great. Okay. So everyone, please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market, and we're going to come into our final segment, and we will be finishing up by talking with Dr. Roderick Long about the 10 objections to libertarian anarchism and the road to peaceful cooperation. So please stay with us. We'll be right back. Okay, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and with me, Dr. Roderick Long and Mr. Luke McGraw. And just before the break, we were going through the 10th objection to libertarian anarchism, which is really a system of peaceful cooperation, and that's why we titled this show Radicals for Peace, Prosperity, and Freedom, and that eventually these private competing protection agencies would become a government. And Roderick, you had just started to answer that. Would you start over on your answer on that particular point?
Yeah, okay. So I think that without government enforcement, cartels are hard to maintain for two reasons. First, all the members of the cartel have an incentive to cheat on the agreement. The you know, price fixing and things like that that are in the incentive, there's an incentive for them all collectively to maintain it, but it's the incentive of any individual to break the agreement. Second, I think more importantly, cartels create an incentive for third parties to come along. And if the cartel hasn't turned itself into a government yet, if it can't actually yet be in a position to outlaw competitors, then it creates a very you know, tempting target for someone to come along and compete with them at you know, at lower rates and more attractive services.
And, of course, the consumers of these services could just not renew the contract at the end of their term with the contracting agency anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, please, Luke, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, so even though the kind of society that we've been talking about is in many ways quite different to the one that we live in today, you don't see this as some sort of utopian vision, do you? There are a lot of advantages to this, and it's something that we might be worth aiming towards.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's utopian, because I think that the ways in which social order is maintained under anarchy are the ways in which most social order is already maintained today. I don't think most social order today comes from government. I think it comes from voluntary cooperation, and government's more or less a parasite on it. So the basic structure, the difference is, you know, and I don't think anarchy would be some kind of fantasy land where everything works out perfectly, but I think that it would have serious advantages over government, because legal system not being a monopoly means that it's not in the same position to abuse power. So you'd expect government to be, or you'd expect legal systems to be more responsive to the people. You expect them to be cheaper. You expect them to be higher quality and to provide more diversity when that's needed. You don't have the kind of informational perversities you have under government. You have it would be smaller, more agile, more responsive to changes in the market. It would be clearer to them what they need to do through competition in order to better satisfy customers. And in particular, you wouldn't have some of the really nasty features that government gives us, like warfare and like the domination of society by wealthy elites and the, you know, the harassment of you know, people who commit so-called victimless crimes, and you know, all the ways that people are just, you know, pushed around and abused. I think it would be a much more prosperous society because all the various regulations government's able to get away with that just sort of slow down cooperation and make it harder for people to produce. So it wouldn't be utopia, but it would be freer, more peaceful, and more prosperous.
You know, I got to say that probably the most powerful thing that I heard you say is that really what we really have primarily in society is a society that's based on voluntary cooperation. That's really what society really is, and that government as it is today really already is a parasite on that peaceful cooperative structure. And we need to appreciate that, celebrate that, expand that, and see how we can actually augment that and get off our prejudice that we need this superstructure. So anyway, thank you very much, Roderick, for being with us today. Dr. Roderick Long, Auburn University, and also our producer and co-host, Mr. Luke McGraw. This is Radio Free Market. Michael McKay, please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can subscribe for free to all of our shows. And until next week, folks, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.